evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. I'm Bill Beckett, the program director for Red River Radio, and with me tonight, Cliff Shackelford, who is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions and calls about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he's held since 1997, and he's also been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he's authored over 60 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two young children live in East Texas. Cliff, thanks again for joining us tonight.
Well, thanks for having me. I always enjoy coming here, and this show is very exciting, so I'm glad we're here tonight.
We do invite you to send in your questions or calls at 800-552-8502. Again, that number is 800-552-8502. We'll give that out throughout the show. Also, if you have a photo and you would like to submit that for Cliff to actually identify live during the show tonight, you need to send that to the following email address. That's rmoran@lsus.edu. rmoran@lsus.edu. And again, we'll give that out throughout the rest of the show as well. And we did have some photos that were submitted online prior to this show. We're going to go to those right now. So let's start out with a photo that came in following the last show back in December. Michael Brooks wrote, "I'm wondering if Cliff could verify that this is indeed an endangered ivory-billed woodpecker. We got a few shots of this guy while vacationing in Devil's Den, Arkansas State Park. And if you would like to follow along as Cliff looks at these, you can. These photos are already online. Just go to redriverradio.org. That's redriverradio.org. At the top of the homepage, you'll see Cliff Shackelford and Bird Calls. Click on that post, and it'll open up the full page, and you can scroll down and follow along. So let's go to this woodpecker. What kind of woodpecker is that?
Well, I'm going to start off by saying it's not an ivory-billed woodpecker. And the good thing is that this guy took some fairly good photos to demonstrate what the bird really is, and they are the expected large woodpecker. These are pileated woodpeckers. I don't know if this is the same individual or two different birds, but there's one of the bird perched on a snag and another of the bird in flight. And you can see the features that separate the two. So let's back up a minute and talk about that. There are two very large woodpeckers that formerly occurred in the southeast, including the listening area here. But unfortunately, one of those is gone. And until somebody can get a slam dunk photo, the ivory billed is not here with us, unfortunately. So most of the sightings nowadays are pileated, and this is the way to do it. If you see what you think is an ivory billed, before you pick up the phone, you need to get your camera. You need to get some proof, because people are not going to believe you without that photograph. This guy did a good job. He took photos. The bird in flight, you can see where the white is positioned on the wings. It's in the wrong place on the wings for it to be an ivory billed. It would be the entire trailing edge would be white. And the bird perched, you can see that there's way too much white in the face and not enough white in the back, the back area, which are the folded wings. It would look like it'd have a white backpack if it were an ivory billed. So for Texas, our last truly documented record was 1904. And in Louisiana, it's much younger than that. There are very good accounts from the Tensaw River bottoms, not far from Monroe, in the late 30s, mid to late 30s, and into the early 1940s. But really, after that, it's just been glimpses and sightings here and there, but not that slam dunk photo that is required. So I'm hopeful there are ivory bills out here, and they would be very nice, because let me mention that this pileated woodpecker that we're looking at and talking about is the bird that got me hooked on birds at the age of 9.
Oh, okay.
So I was super impressed. It was at our family property in Cherokee County, Texas, not far from New Summerfield, where this giant bird flew past me and landed on the tree like a woodpecker and hitched up like a woodpecker, but it was huge. And I thought, what on earth is this? So I remember as a kid running back to talk to my dad about it. He grew up in Livingston in Polk County, Texas, and he learned the colloquial names, and he called it the Law God, and I didn't like that name. So I remember going back when growing up in Dallas, going to the public library at Preston Royal and asking the very nice librarian where the bird books were. And she took me to the bird books, and that's where I discovered a Roger Torrey Peterson field guide. And if you just open the book up naturally, right where the seam is, where the staples are, is the woodpecker plate. So it was really neat that I opened the book and there was the pileated woodpecker, what my dad called the log god. But I like the name in the book a lot better, pileated woodpecker. Pileum is a crest or a top notch. So that's what the bird is named for.
And of course, one of the things you can also tell a bird by is not just their looks, but their sounds as well.
Yes, that's a good point. Thanks, Bill, because the two birds sound very different. And that's another thing, if you don't have a camera and you're hearing the bird vocalize, and I do this with my cell phone, I have a smartphone, I can turn on the video and just use the sound and capture that vocalization. So you don't need to have an image on that sound, on that video file, just getting the sound of the bird, and they're drastically different. They sing different tunes, just as different as Willie Nelson from Johnny Cash. Right. And so the voice is very distinct on those two.
And here's an example of what a pileated, I don't have an ivory-billed woodpecker, but here's the pileated woodpecker. There we go. Okay, so that would be what a pileated woodpecker would sound like.
And that last call is a good one, because there's another colloquial name that a lot of people know is the Indian hen. And that last call you heard is the clucking, where half of that name came from. The hen, H-E-N part, is from that cluck, 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 cluck. And the Indian part is from the drumming, the brrrr. So Indian hen is a great colloquial name. I really like that one for the pileated woodpecker. So the ivory billed sounded like a toy trumpet is what it was described as sounding like. And it made kind of, I'll try to imitate it. It's more of a... So a tooting note, and very trumpet-like. And the only sound recordings we have of that species come from Louisiana. And it came from a project that I mentioned a minute ago from the Tensaw River bottoms, south of Monroe, in the late 30s. And a fellow by the name of James Tanner, working on a PhD under Arthur A. Allen, he recorded, those guys recorded the only known sounds of an ivory-billed woodpecker. So you can actually go online and find those sound vouchers and hear it, and it's pretty neat.
All right. And now we do have another photo that was submitted. This was submitted in January from Kelly Wayne Dishman, and she wrote that she had a picture of a bird, and she's unable to identify that, and she had taken this photo in North Bossier, close to Cypress Lake. So what kind of bird? And that would be the third online, if you're following along online. That would be the third photo down in our series there. And can you tell us what this bird is?
And this bird is sitting in a willow tree, and there are some of the willow leaves obstructing the view, but I can see enough of the bird to know what it is. The general overall color is a slaty gray, kind of small-headed, and a very distinctive black tail with a little bit of a notch to it. And this is the Mississippi kite, and we have those nesting locally in the listening area, and they're thickest though along the Red River. So the Shreveport area, they would be very thick up and down the Red River. They like real open areas. They eat a lot of aerial arthropods, things like dragonflies. Mm-hmm. I've seen them coming into the canopy after cicadas, what people often call locusts.
Right.
But locust is a grasshopper, and the cicada is different. And
Beverly
so,
Burden would applaud you for that.
Yeah, that's right. That's another show. I'll let Beverly talk about the bugs. But these guys are eating bugs, and they do eat some birds as well. They'll eat nestling birds out of the nest. They'll snatch things out of the nest. Swallowtail kites, another species that does a lot of that too. So let's back up a minute. So these kites that I'm talking about, Mississippi kite, it's a raptor. Okay. It's a bird of prey. So he's related to hawks and falcons, and they're just a lot more dainty. They stay aloft a lot. They look like they've really mastered flight, and they're catching a lot of stuff on the wing. And you might not notice it, but all of a sudden, if you watch them, they'll dart over or dive, and if you watch with binoculars, you'll see they're going to use their foot in flight and start eating a dragonfly in flight. It's pretty neat.
You're listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, who is also the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position that he's held for the past 30 years. And he is with us tonight to answer your questions. You can call in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we do have our first caller online, Bailey from Marshall. You're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
Periodically, I hear a bird song in my backyard. I've never been able to identify the source of the thing, but it goes like that.
What
is that?
Okay, and yeah, it's very frustrating to hear these little guys, because this guy's little, and I'm going to tell you what it is, but the Carolina chickadee makes that kind of song. You did a very good imitation of a Carolina chickadee. And so we're in the South, and we have the Southern chickadee. It's called the Carolina. If you grew up in the Northeast, you learned the black cap chickadee, but we have the Carolina chickadee here. And they make a very perfect whistle like you just imitated. And if you can ever see one, they're pretty easy to see. They're black and white, and they're really cute little guys, and they have a pretty loud voice. And it's Carolina chickadee.
All right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you bet.
Thanks for your call. And if you'd like to call in right now, you can. The number to call is 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 to get your call in with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. We have one more photo submitted literally today online from Roy Blake in Nacogdoches, and he writes, please see the attached photo to help identify. I think it's a willet. It was spotted on March 15th, 2014, not too long ago, on the Boulevard Peninsula, Crystal Beach, Texas. And can you tell us what that
sure.
is?
Sure. And while before we jump into that, I might mention that there are a whole bunch of other birds. Let's go back to Bailey's call. There's also the white-throated sparrow, I should mention, that makes a very clear whistle. And he's going to be singing very low. So if you hear clear whistles coming from low to the ground, it's probably a white-throated sparrow. The chickadee I mentioned is usually going to be up in the trees, but they both have very clear whistles, but they are different. So I wanted to make sure that I pointed that out, because he could have had also white-throated sparrows singing too. And they make a very clear so I'm now rethinking what I said to Bailey. So I think if he goes out and listens for that bird, they don't sound at all alike, but white-throated sparrow and Carolina chickadee make very clear whistles, and they sing up a storm. Now, the sparrow doesn't nest here, but they do sing here, especially on warm days, even cold or winter days when the sun's out and it can be cold, they'll sing, and it's a beautiful whistle song. So let's go to the coast here. We're looking at the photograph of a bird on the beach. You can look out and see nothing but ocean there on the Gulf there. And this is a willet. And it's a large shorebird that you will see on the Gulf Coast just about any month of the year. Well, every month of the year. If you go visit the Gulf Coast of Texas or Louisiana, you're going to see a willet. They're gray. They have a very straight, stout bill, pretty chunky legs, and they're usually in the surf. And they're grabbing stuff that when the tide goes back and forth, they're running out there to get things that the tide is swishing around. This time of the year, you'll see little white, palish, whitish-looking, hunched-over shorebirds called sanderlings running in around the willets. So it's a lot of fun to go down there and see these shorebirds. They're all doing different things. They have different bills to feed differently. And this one here we're looking at is simply known as a willet, one word name, like Madonna or Elvis. So this is the willet.
So it's the cool bird out
it's
there.
It's the cool bird, yeah.
All right. So now we do have an anonymous online caller. They sent in their question. They said they were pretty sure they had seen a peregrine falcon, but they wanted to know if they and osprey are in our area.
Yeah, the answer is yes. And the osprey is here a lot longer, a lot more opportunity to see the osprey in our listening area throughout the year. There's probably not a month that goes by that you can't find an osprey, because their migration period is very long, open window. There are a few that stick around and breed. There's a nesting pair on Toledo Bend, maybe more than one. That's the reservoir that Texas and Louisiana shares on the border. On the southern end, there's been a nest there that I've seen near 6 Mile. And you can see the ospreys nesting there. They'll winter with us. The peregrine, though, is not going to be here in the dead of summer. So they'll start showing up when the shorebirds arrive. They usually follow shorebirds and show up in July, August. And they're really headed to the coast. So a dead of winter sighting is possible, but mostly we see peregrines in migration, spring and fall migration, but you just won't see them in the dead of summer.
And you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can call in with your question right now about anything dealing with birds in our avian world at 800-552-8502. Again, that's 800-552-8502. If you'd like to submit a photo during the show, please send it to the following email address, rmoran@lsus.edu. That's R-M-O-R-A-N at lsus.edu. And we have a call online right now, a truck driver out there running. I'm not sure if he's out there driving right now, but he's out on Highway 259. And from Redmond, what's your question tonight?
Yeah, actually, I am driving right now.
All right.
about a month ago, I was in the Austin area for about 3 or 4 weeks, and I kept seeing a large black raptor with white bands through the middle of its wings. The wings kind of looked like a U-2 spy plane, the way that they were curved, not fanned out like a hawk or an eagle, but very tapered on the end, but about the same length. And I was having a heck of a time trying to find anything online that looked like it.
Well, I'm guessing what you saw was a caracara, and they're not black, though. They're pretty dark brown, and they have big white wing patches. They're in the Austin area, and they really throw people because they're just unusual, and they are expanding. A lot of people that have not seen them before are really thrown by them. One of the local names is Mexican Eagle. But the correct common name is crested caracara, and he's a bird of prey. He's related to falcons, and you'll see them a lot near the road's edge. They eat a lot of carrion. They'll be sometimes in association with vultures at a roadkill, and that's what I'm guessing you saw as a caracara.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I kept looking at it, and I said, wow, that looks kind of like an eagle. I had went to a bald eagle, and there's another South American variation. It looks kind of like a bald eagle, but I just couldn't find a good representation of it online.
Yeah, because they do have a white head, but the white in the wing that you described is got to be the caracara. So
how would you spell that?
C-A-R-A-C-A-R-A. That's one word, caracara.
This is the beauty of public radio, because I just by chance tuned in to you, and I'm coming down the highway. Haven't been in Texas in a month, and...
Yeah.
The answer to that question has been driving me nuts.
Well, cool. And so you're multitasking. You're driving, talking on the phone, and bird watching. I love it. So
hands-free, though. Hands-free. I'm not touching my phone as I
good.
Go along.
No, I approve of the bird watching, so that's good. You got your eyes open for the caracaras out there.
Oh, perfect.
Good.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for your call. We appreciate it. And if you'd like to call in right now, you can to get your question on with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. The number to call, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Carlos from Big Sandy, you're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Yes, I have a question about hummingbirds. I always assume and from hearing from the neighbors and everybody around here that they all migrate. All the birds leave and none of them stay behind. But my wife kept on telling me, no, that she's seen some that stay behind. She was sure. And sure enough, we left our feeder out there. And during the middle of winter, we saw one little hummingbird that came around to feed. And he seemed to have survived the winter. I had no idea. I thought they all would leave the area.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And actually, in the book that was mentioned earlier that I co-authored, we recommend in the mild south to leave your hummingbird feeder up for the very reason you mentioned. We get a lot of hummingbirds that will overwinter with us because it's mild. Now, this winter, it was pretty darn chilly, and I didn't hear about as many hummingbirds overwintering as in other years. But that's great that you found that, because that's that's when you're going to find your better chance of finding something unusual is going to be in the winter, and it's going to be maybe something like a rufous hummingbird. So what you want to do is try to get a picture of it next time, and that would make it easier to identify. But I know hummingbird photography is very difficult. These birds zip around. It's very hard to do it. But that's great that you kept your feeder up, and you guys are correct that they are migratory, and most of them in the big sandy area, those are ruby-throated hummingbirds, and those guys typically get out of here in October. So by November 1st, they're very hard to find. But if those of us that leave our feeders up might get rewarded with an overwintering hummingbird, and you guys did. So what a treat. That's great. And the feeder maintenance is the same. You want to do 4 parts water to 1 part sugar. The good thing is when it's cooler, you don't have to change it out as much as you do is when it's hot in August or September. You want to change it out every 2 or 3 days. But in the winter, you can let it go a little while because the cool weather keeps it a bit fresh. So speaking of hummingbirds, I saw my first one in the listening area today. I was at some friends of mine, the Wolfs, in Central Heights, and there came a male ruby throat, and they said that was the first one they'd seen. They saw him earlier in the morning. So that's about right. Mid-March is when the male ruby throat starts showing up in the listening area.
All right, and related to that, we had a question that actually came in during our last fun drive, and this was from a listener who wanted to know if the rufous hummingbird that they had not seen in January would have either left or frozen, and so they were curious as to what had happened to that bird that they were used to seeing.
I doubt that the bird froze. I think that, if anything, it just kept moving. So some people are lucky, and they will get a rufous to stay with them all winter long. They can start showing up in Texas in late July, early August, and then stay with us for a good 6 months. So some lucky few people will get them to stay that whole period, but a lot of people, they just get them when they're in transit. So I'm guessing that they just saw the bird for a little bit, and it kept moving. Mm-hmm. And the cold weather would have probably stimulated that.
You are listening to Bird Calls. We have James coming up next. And Lindsay, you're online. You'll be up in a few moments. If you'd like to get in your call right now, you can call us at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is with us. He's our resident ornithologist, and he is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department.
And that word ornithologist, let me point out that is a technical word for a bird biologist. So I think people might have heard of herpetologist. That mm-hmm. would be the equivalent with reptiles, right? Yeah. An ichthyologist would be the equivalent with fish, and so on. But an ornithologist is just a jazzy word for a bird biologist.
So. Okay. And we do have James online from Longview. James, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
My question is, there is a parking lot in Longview that regularly has a flock of seagulls in it. And I've noticed these seagulls for 20 years. And I'm just curious about the behavior and why would the seagulls venture so far inland?
Yeah, I'm guessing those are ring-billed gulls, ring as ring around the collar-billed gulls, and those guys have really increased in our area. They're not new, but they have grown in numbers, and what lures them inland are the reservoirs that we've created. And so then on top of that, they really like to go to parking lots because there's always scraps, you know, the French fries that fall out of the drive-through window and the dumpster that's open and the garbage. So they're very opportunistic. If you watch gulls on the coast, if there's a dead fish, they'll pick at it. And it's not much different what they're picking at in the parking lot. So my guess is those are ring-billed gulls, and they're only here in the winter. They don't breed in Texas, but they are here in big numbers, and you will see them inland. So I think we can thank the reservoirs for luring them inland, and then they stick around because of all the human activity and the easy pickings they have that we provide them, unknowingly provide them.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can get your questions in right now at 800-552-8502. Again, that number is 800-552-8502. If you have a question about anything dealing with birds, Cliff will be happy to try to answer all of those tonight. And we do have Lindsay on the phone from Alexandria. Lindsay, you're on with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Yes, Cliff. I was wondering, we recently put up one of the little bells, little feeder that, you know, it's like pressed seeds and the like, and saw a very slight bird with a kind of a rusty reddish brown kind of all on his head and down his back. It looked like a pair. The female was much gray with a few white bars, about two-thirds the size of a sparrow, but much thinner in build. Wondered if you had any idea what that might be.
Could they have been house finch, maybe? You said that the male or one of them was a little reddish. Is that what you said?
Yeah, it was, and I looked in the bird book, and the bird books I had showed a house finch is almost pink, where this was a much, much reddish brown, much darker, and not a very bright color at all.
Okay. Yeah, I'm guessing, you know, the house finch is probably it. If it was paired up with somebody that was very drab, the female house finch is just a kind of a earth tone brown, very speckled, and no color other than that. So I'm guessing house finch, and they are pretty common in our area, and they'll come to those feeders. Because okay. Otherwise it's going to be, and I'm sure you know what a female cardinal looks like.
Yeah, no, so, that wasn't that.
Yeah.
I mean, cardinals will come into it too.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm just guessing that maybe bad lighting is maybe why it looks so crisp in the book and maybe not so jazzy outside the window. The lighting can play a role in that.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate it.
Okay, you bet.
You can get online right now with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist, by calling 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any questions dealing with birds, birding, and our avian world, Cliff will be happy to answer those. And we do have a question. Again, this one came in during our fun drive, and the question was, how do you feed songbirds without feeding blackbirds?
If someone could figure that out, they would probably be famous and rich. But I don't know the answer to that. That, you know, if you put out a broadcast seed or an open platform seed feeder, you're going to get blackbirds coming in there. You know, the one that most people don't like are the red-winged blackbird that come in big numbers and will drain the seed quickly. The only way to really do it is to switch to a thistle and get a special feeder that the red-winged blackbird cannot get to the seed. So your goldfinches and your chickadees might be able to get to it, but the blackbird can't. So it might be just something simple like trying a different feeder design. But if you're just throwing seed out on the ground, boy, you're making it really easy on the red-winged blackbirds. And I can't blame them for coming in big numbers and going after easy pickings.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, free food is free
food.
Yeah,
that's so right.
Now, mourning doves are a very popular bird, and you wanted to kind of talk about and spotlight those. Let's go into that a little bit.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about the life of mourning doves in this area.
Well, we try to highlight a different species every bird call show, and so we picked the mourning dove for this episode. And I'm going to start by saying it's named after its mournful, sad coos. It's not mourning as in good morning. It's named for the sad, mournful coos, and we're hearing that right now.
It's a pretty, pretty sound, though. I enjoy actually listening to these in the morning, in the quiet of the morning, because it is such a plaintive kind of sound.
They are nice. Yeah, they sound, you know, a little owl-like, that little hooting-like. But it's definitely the mourning dove is a call that you're going to hear throughout the listening area. And it is very pleasant. So named for the mournful coos. They're year-round here. They make the sloppiest nests I can think of. I've never seen a more of a slacker bird make a nest where you can get under it and almost see through it. It's just thrown together and not well built, but it doesn't matter because they're doing something right, because we have lots of mourning doves. Now, some people tell you mourning dove numbers are going down. There's many theories on that. I'm not sure, but I you know, some in parts of central Texas where white winged doves have really exploded, people are noticing that the white winged doves are taking over where mourning doves once were, and I don't know the reason for that. But in our area, we, you know, white-winged dove is still pretty hard to find, but mourning doves are very commonly found.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And if you'd like to get your calls in tonight, the number to call, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Also, you can submit a photo online right now by sending it to the following email address, rmoran@lsus.edu. That's R-M-O-R-A-N at lsus.edu. And we'll post your photos online after the show. Now, we do have a call online. Jill from Marshall, Texas. You're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Hi, good evening. Thanks so much for taking my call, and I love the show.
Great.
Question is kind of a twofold thing. With the harsh winter and the cold temperatures, I'm wondering if the behavior I saw was unusual because of the weather patterns we've been having. First time I've ever experienced a situation where I was watching my birds feeding at the feeder, and they also feed on the ground and in the bushes. And out of the blue came a bird of prey, just, oh my gosh, like a shark doing a shark attack. Mm-hmm. And it came down, swooped down, all the birds took off. He tried to grab a bird, you know, and then he took off in flight chasing one of these small birds, and I have never seen that before. It was a very cold day, early morning in January, and it just took me by surprise. My husband thought it might have been a kestrel. We have lots of Mississippi kites around here, but they're not here in the wintertime. And it was a small kind of spotted, definitely, you know, he paused and sat there in front of my window like he was catching his breath.
Okay.
And then he took off after some more birds.
Well, what you described is an accipiter. And we have two species in the listening area, the sharp-shinned hawk and the Cooper's hawk. So a lot of the old-timers will call them a blue darter. And they're kind of blue-gray, and they dart in and dart out. They love bird feeders because it's like Grand Central Station. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of activity there, and the smart birds get the heck out of there, and the not-so-smart birds take flight. And let me tell you, you're not going to win when that acceptor comes in. He's already got a head start on you, and he's moving quickly. He'll grab you in mid-flight. So they typically they're bird eaters, and they like to grab birds out of the air. So the smart bird would just sit on the feeder, maybe tuck around the other side or duck it down into the bushes, but don't get up and fly away because you're going to be sharp-shinned hawk lunch.
I'll put a sign out by the bird feeder saying that.
Yeah.
And hopefully they can read.
Great. Thanks so much.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. He is also the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And he's with us tonight taking your phone calls at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we've got a couple of online questions right now. The first one is from Ann Tyndall. And it is, last summer was unusual in that I rarely heard one of my favorite birds at this place. It's the wood thrush. Any reason why they would be almost absent last summer after many years of being common at her place?
The wood thrush is absolutely one of the best songsters that we have in the listening area. And I would extend that to globally. It's in the top few songsters out there. Beautiful melodic song. Very flute-like, and it is a bird that is declining precipitously. And on the local scale, I would bet that something happened to the woodlot, and it could have grown out of succession, or it could have experienced some cutting farther down, but they're real sensitive on the size of the woodlot that they pick, or the riparian area, riparian stream zone. So they're not always associated with streams, but they usually are. And they usually like big, mature woods. And so if something happens to those woods, they could be gone. Or that one individual, he might come back to that spot every year. Well, he's going to die of old age. He's going to have hazards along the way. He could have hit a window, gotten caught by a cat or some other awful death, but he could have respectfully died of old age. So there's no way to know, but I'm guessing that if a wood thrush is not replacing it, that maybe something has happened to the habitat, the condition of the woodlot.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio. The number to call, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 to get your question in with Cliff. We do have another online question, and this one is from Tanya from Pineville, I presume. And it says, I commute to LA Tech from Pineville and have noticed a bluish heron north of Dodson. Could it be the great blue heron?
Yes, that's probably what it is. And they are year-round here, and a lot of people call them blue cranes or just crane. But we don't have, in the true Piney Woods, we don't have sandhill cranes, except very rarely flying over. But if you see a bird in the water, like in a ditch along the highway, and it's a gray-blue, it's this time of the year, it's probably a great blue heron. There's a smaller relative called the little blue heron, and they'll start showing up here shortly. But they are a solid blue with purple. They're just beautiful, but maybe half or third the size of the great blue heron. So I'm guessing that she did identify it correctly as great blue heron. And I wanted to point out that we don't see these online questions ahead of time. We don't get these phone calls ahead of time. So these are all, we're shooting quick from the hip right now. So we sadly don't get to study these things. And
part of the fun of radio is working without a net, especially live radio. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. Maybe put the challenge to us and help us out on our call-in show tonight. It's called Bird Calls, and Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist. 800-552-8502, the number for you to call to get your question in. And I had one more that came in during the fun drive, and this is from Jackson Oliver, who wanted to know what kind of bird makes a kind of a peanut-shaped gourd-like nest.
It's not the bird that's making it, and what it is, it's a human putting out the gourd, and those are intended for the purple martin.
Oh, okay.
And so people buy those, they drill a little hole in them, and the purple martins will use them. And used to, in the old days, people would use real squash-type gourds, but nowadays you can buy ones made out of plastic, and of course they will last, you know, probably 50 times longer than an old gourd, squash gourd would, but those are for purple martins.
Okay.
And they nest communally, so if you just put one out and want purple martins, it's not gonna work. You need to put multiples out because they like to nest in groups. They're colonial nesters.
Yeah, and purple martins are wonderful for a backyard mosquito repellent type birds as well.
Well, they eat a lot of dragonflies, unfortunately, and so that was kind of a really good publicity stunt that started in the 50s and 60s saying that purple martins would reduce your mosquito numbers.
Really?
But it really is not accurate because they're eating a lot more dragonflies. And actually, if you have a mosquito problem, you want dragonflies because they're a better predator of mosquitoes than the purple martin.
Well, that's interesting because that was one of those myths that I had purple martins on my property in Florida.
Right.
I wanted to ask about the sandhill crane. Do they not overwinter down here at all?
They do overwinter in parts of the listening area and especially on the coast, but then they all get up and retreat and leave in the spring. And so if you live farther west of here, when I lived in Austin, for example, along the I-35 corridor, they would be pouring over right now in mid-March, and you can hear them. They fly during the day, and they make their call during the day, and you don't see them, but you'll hear them, and you'll look up, and you'll see little pepperflex and their sandhill cranes flying over. But those are wintering in South Texas, and so they're going the same direction as I-35.
In Florida, they wintered just south of where I was at, and there was a huge wetlands there, and so there were thousands of them out there.
And there's some that do stay year-round. There's the Mississippi Crane Refuge in Mississippi in the coast of Mississippi that has sandhills that stay year-round. So there are exceptions to the rule, but the rule is most of our sandhills are migratory, and we just don't have a lot of them in this listening area.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. His the number to call, 800-552-8502, if you'd like to get a question in. And we do have a question from Clyde in Nacogdoches. Clyde, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, actually, it's more has he seen something. A few years ago, we had one of our bad drought years, 2 years running, and we had a bird feeder that we mainly stocked with sunflower seed near our kitchen window where we could watch the birds and enjoyed it. But we had a pair of pileated woodpeckers who had got onto the bird feeder. Have you ever seen that?
I have seen it, but not for sunflower. I've seen them come to soot cakes, S-U-E-T, soot.
Right. I would expect.
Right.
But I never even thought about them. But I'll tell you what, there weren't any of the other birds who disputed their right of way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I bet when that pileated landed there, everybody gave him the...
They gave him lots of room and space.
So what did you see? Did he eat them whole, or did he take them off, or what did he do?
It looked like it kind of made up. Opened his beak and kind of got him, sort of scooped up a beak full and went off.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
I don't know if he swallowed them or...
Yeah, he probably had to just because of what he's equipped with and how small sunflower seeds are. He would have to do it by swallowing them whole. But I've never seen that personally. That's neat.
I had a pair of them.
Oh, neat.
We didn't usually see both of them on it at the same instant. One of them often was perched on the tree, and one would get on it, and then the other one would get on it.
Yeah. Well, maybe you're right. The drought forced them to think outside the box, and they had to eat that because there wasn't anything else.
Now, we had a red-bellied woodpecker pair that lived in the that apparently nested in the somewhere in the immediate vicinity.
Mm-hmm.
And for several years, we saw them come in every, particularly every spring, and they would bring a chick. It was clearly their chick of that year, and it would sit on one of the trees after it had fledged and was flying, and it would sit on a tree, and the parents would take turns getting flying down, getting a seed, a sunflower seed, flying up and kind of wedged at the bark of the tree.
Yes, and I have seen that with red-bellies in my yard, too. We have a very rough bark pecan tree, and the red-bellies will get a sunflower seed, go up to the pecan, find a little crevice in the bark, and wedge that sunflower seed and peck at it until they can get the nugget out. So I have seen red-bellies do that. That's neat that you saw it then feed the young bird, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's pretty neat.
Yeah, it would. They would actually... did kind of wedge it in and peck at it a little bit, but not actually, it didn't look like they were actually cracking it, or getting it out. And then the chick would peck at it.
Right.
I assume, I had gotten the idea.
Yeah, that's neat. And that's something that we humans should relate to that's kind of unique for birds is that the parental care thing is there. You don't have that with a lot of reptiles and insects. They just lay eggs and they leave the parents. But birds, like many mammals, they stick around and have parental care activities and duties and raise the young, and the young learn from that. So that's what really gets a lot of people interested in birds is that they can relate to these things. And I have to remind folks when they get dive bombed by a barn swallow that's nesting on the front porch that those are just being good parents. Those birds are not out to really hurt you. They just want you to get away from the nest. So they're being good parents. We can learn a lot from a bird.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and we are a community supported public broadcasting service of LSUS. The phone number to call right now if you would like to get your call into Cliff is 800-552-8502. Again, that's 800-552-8502. If you'd like to submit a question online or a photograph or even a sound of a bird, you can send that to this email address, rmoran@lsus.edu. That's rmoran at lsus.edu. We have Paul from Nacogdoches on the phone right now. Paul, you're online with Cliff Shackelford.
Okay,
what's your question?
Thank you very much for taking my call. This was our last day before Thanksgiving last year. I was in the Nacogdoches area. I think I was on 59. And on the right side of the highway, out spills about seven skinny turkeys. I think they were males. They just spilled out of the woods and then just turned around real quick and went right back in.
Okay.
It's sort of like a slinky, you know. They came out and then went right back in.
Was that South 59 between the river, between Angelina River and Nacogdoches?
I think, yeah, around there.
There was a release done on a property between the Angelina River and the loop of Nacogdoches, and that's probably what you saw. Those were birds released, and they're doing fairly well. There's still some out there. And I'm guessing that's it. So the point of that is that they're wild turkey. That's the common name, but those birds were moved from somewhere else. So East Texas is doing a pretty active job of trying to get birds from other states to recolonize.
The convention is something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's funny. Well, I'm glad that they turned around and went back in the woods, because it's going to be probably ultimate death if they try to walk across Highway 59. So that's pretty neat that you saw those. Those are restocking efforts.
That would be a real mess if they tried to complicate on 59.
Right.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can call in right now at 800-552-8502 to get your question in. Again, that's 800-552-8502. We have Chuck online from Texarkana. And what's your question tonight, Chuck?
Yes, sir. I was at Walmart a while back, and I noticed the birds in the parking lot were picking up potato chips someone's spilled, and they look like a mockingbird, but they're black. I was just wondering what kind of birds those are.
They look like a mockingbird, but they were black.
Yeah, their body was shaped like a mockingbird, but they were black.
Okay, were they female great-tailed grackles, maybe? You said...
I have no idea. I've never seen them anywhere before.
Tell me again where you saw it. I couldn't pick that up.
It was at the Walmart in Texarkana.
Yeah, I bet those are great-tailed grackles. And they're pretty uniformly colored. They're I'd call more of a chocolate brown, milk chocolate brown. The males are big and black with long tails, but they're the birds that get in these big roosts, and they're very noisy. You don't want to park your car under one of those roosts, because it'll be covered in poo. But I'm guessing those were great-tailed grackles, and they were probably females, and they would definitely do what you described, eating potato chips.
Okay, well, I've never seen them before.
Yeah.
I was just curious.
Yep.
All right. We thank you for your call, and you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio. And you can call in right now at 800-552-8502 if you'd like to get a question in to Cliff Shackelford. He is our resident ornithologist, and he is also the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And we have Gary from Wilmington, Minnesota online next. Gary, what's your question tonight?
Well, hi, I've got a question about migration, and it's kind of interesting hearing about Texas winter down there. Is this still in the midst of winter right now? In fact, it's snowing.
Wow.
And I saw a flock of waxwings that just arrived, and I wondered what happens when birds are coming up and hit a real patch of bad weather. If it's short, they'll probably hunker in the tree. But will they back up and, you know, go for a little bit further south if it's bad, or will they just typically just wait it out?
Well, and you mentioned cedar waxwing, right? So why don't we talk about that one real quick? That they're pretty much looking for any kind of shrub or tree that's got fruit on it. And so they definitely are wandering around, and they're more concerned with finding food probably than really the weather. So a lot of these birds, at least down here where we are, they can handle these cold snaps. Now, you're in Minnesota. You notice in the winter that your species diversity drops to rock bottom in the dead of winter. Yeah. But I think what happens is you've got a lot of birds that it depends on what they eat. Now, when I've seen fall migrants that were swallows, and when they hit an early cold front as they're marching south and they can't get ahead of the front, after about two or three days and they can't refuel and eat, they die. So to put it mildly, they can't go back, they can't go ahead of it. There's nothing behind it except cold weather. So I think in the fall, that's a really bad time, and it's because they have to eat insects they catch on the wing. So that would be something to think about. The answer depends on what the critter is eating. So a swallow eating bugs on the wing is a big problem when there's cold weather, an early fall front. So this time of the year, migration is really stimulated by day length, and that doesn't really change. So when the days get longer, it pushes birds north, and a lot of them, depending on what they eat, can make it. So some birds even switch what they're eating. You'll see a lot of things like yellow rump warblers will switch to mistletoe and other things until the bugs come back out. But once the temperature gets down below 50 and you're an insect eater, you're probably out of luck. So you either need to, like you said, pack up or hope for some warmer weather to come relieve things.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. And you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio. And Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist. You can call in right now. We have time for a few more calls. 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502.
What I wanted to point out with the caller from Minnesota is that we have a lot of connection that people don't realize. We share birds.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the birds that we're going to start seeing here that were spending the winter in the tropics are going to come to Texas, Louisiana. And then a few weeks later, maybe a month later, they're going to be in this guy's backyard in Minnesota. Things like rose-breasted grosbeak, northern oriole, Baltimore oriole, those things are going to be birds that we all share. So it's kind of neat that and it's neat to hear that there's still snow on the ground somewhere else. But I think it's cool that we're going to be sending some birds up his way here pretty soon. Now we're starting spring migration here. This is my favorite time to be in the listening area. The last half of March is when a lot of birds start showing up that we haven't seen in about 6 months, 4 months, a long time. And it's great to see the very first northern Perula or black and white warbler or Louisiana wire thrush. Those kinds of things come in early. And then we're going to get another wave of birds. And some of those are going to end up in Minnesota. So it's kind of neat that we'll see a lot of the same birds about a month before he will in Minnesota.
So I have a quick question. As someone who grew up in Ohio, we always knew spring had arrived when we saw a robin nesting. Now, where do robins go during the wintertime?
Well, we do have robins staying in small numbers and nesting here. So they don't all leave us. We just get a huge influx in the winter of more northern breeders. I think the smart robins are the ones that are going to go see this guy in Minnesota because the weather's just so much more pleasant than what we have to offer in the summer. So
absolutely,
yeah, it pays to be a migrant. I think about there's no perfect place to live if you grow your roots year-round somewhere, but I think a migrant bird has it made because they can go to the best areas depending on the season and see a big part of the world and always have that perfect weather. So I'm real envious of a lot of these migrant birds because of that. Because here we are in the South, we love our winters here, but my goodness, we're sweaty and miserable in August when that rose-breasted grosbeak is still up in Minnesota and enjoying the cool late summer weather.
Yeah, and of course in Florida the largest bird flock were the snowbirds, which were the retirees that came down during the wintertime, and then they went back to the cool weather in the summertime.
Yeah, and that's why they're called snowbirds, because they're migratory and they're smart.
They are smart. So we have time for a couple of more calls. You can call in at 800-552-8502. Tanya from Huntington, Texas, you're on with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Hello. Thank you guys for taking my call. I have a probably silly question, but this has kind of been something I've been wondering. I live out in the country, and my closest neighbor, he has about 18 bird feeders in his yard. And so I decided a couple of months ago, if I can't beat him, I might as well join him. So I put out some bird feeders. And I've been watching them feed on my porch, but I've noticed there is a bird that I only hear him after dark. I don't hear him during the day. And he doesn't chirp. He literally sings. It's very loud, and it almost sounds like a flute or some type of instrument. And I just wondered if you might have any idea what it is I'm hearing. I haven't seen him.
Okay. Is he singing this time of the year?
Yes, because I've only been feeding these birds for 3 or 4 months now.
And it only sings at night, and it sounds
only
like...
Only at night.
And when you say night, do you mean pitch dark?
Right. If I come out on my porch 9 or 10 o'clock at night, I've heard him 3 different nights now.
Okay. Well, there is... I'm not sure what it is, but I'll tell you from my experience, there is a night sound that wasn't here... decades ago. It's an introduced amphibian. It's the chirping frog, and I get a lot of calls about what is that bird singing at night. And when I ask them, what do you mean by night? Is it pitch dark? Oh yeah, it's 10 p.m. and it's chirping away. It's a frog. And
are you serious?
Yep. And so I would get out there and look. You probably won't see him. He's about the size of your pinky nail. Or maybe your thumbnail, but definitely a fingernail-sized frog. He's usually low on shrubs or volunteer trees, and usually in a thickety area. And they love going around the houses because we water, we keep things lush. There's plenty of bugs to eat. And so I haven't had one in my yard this last year, but the year before, we had a couple of Rio Grande chirping frogs calling, and they're moved around with the potting industry, the flower industry. So you'll get something shipped in from Brownsville or McAllen, Texas, and he'll just ride on that truck, and then he gets into your yard in Huntington, and he finds it very suitable, and he'll sing at night, and it's the Rio Grande chirping frog. Believe it or not. So it's not a bird. And I get that call a lot at Parks and Wildlife. One of my duties is to answer calls like on this radio show. So people call, and when they say they have a bird question, they channel those to the bird person. But I get a lot of those, and they're actually a reptile question, and it's the or an amphibian question. It's the chirping frog is what you're hearing.
That's cool. I'm going to go online and see if I can't find the sound online.
I
think that's exactly what I'm hearing.
Yeah. And actually, when we had ours a couple years ago, we had to we'd hear him on cool nights. We'd have the windows open. He was right under the window, and he got so annoying that we started closing our windows. So because it's so irregular, if it just like katydids at night in the summer, that's a very monotonous call by an insect, and that's very soothing. But the chirping frog is erratic and sporadic, and it would keep me awake, and I had to close the window from the calls of the chirping frog.
And we have just about maybe 20 seconds to answer this online question. John from Pineville wanted to know, he used to see more quail in the area, but he's not seeing them nearly as much. Is there a reason for that?
Yeah, quail have been plummeting, absolutely plummeting since the 60s. Continental estimate is about a 67% decline continentally, and you can really tie that with what we're doing with our grasslands. We are treating our grasslands very differently than what quail want, so the answer is non-native grass is decimating our bobwhite quail.
All right, Cliff, I want to thank you again for joining us tonight. If you did not get your call in, and we do have a couple of calls waiting, you are welcome to go ahead and send your question in to us at rmoran@lsus.edu, rmoran@lsus.edu, and we'll have Cliff answer those on our next Bird Calls show, which will be coming up in May. And we are every other month now with Bird Calls, so we're going to be doing this bi-monthly or 6 times a year. I'm not sure what the correct term is there. But you are welcome to call in during that show as well. You've been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We want to thank everybody at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help on this program. And I personally want to thank Cliff again for coming in tonight and lending his expertise to us. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and we are a community-supported public broadcasting service of LSUS. This is KDAQ, Shreveport, Bossier City, KLSA, Alexandria, Pineville, KBSA, El Dorado, Magnolia, and KLDN, Lufkin, Nacogdoches. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is next.